Hello and welcome to DNA Today. I'm your host, Kira Deneen. DNA Today informs you on what's happening in the genetic world, shows packed news stories and lessons, all to keep you updated and educated on the ever-changing world of genetics. And you can tune in every Monday at 11:30 a.m. to hear me live on WHUS.org or on the radio 91.7 FM. Last week, I had Sophia on the air, and she talked about her event, Rare Diseases Awareness Event 2015, which was held at the UConn Health Center. And I was actually able to go and hear the presentations and really get a sense of rare diseases. It was kind of my first exposure to a presentation like that. And so I want to get into all the fantastic presentations from physicians as well as patients that have taken a very active role with fighting their family's disease. And it was a great mix of presentations. You know, you had those physicians, you had those patients, really letting the audience know what it's like to be on either end. Before I get into all that, though, I do want to mention that the 10th Annual Podcast Award nominations have been announced, and DNA Today has been nominated. We've been nominated under the general category, so you can go to podcastawards.com, scroll down to the general category on the left, and vote for DNA Today. Voting starts tomorrow, so please vote. Thank you so much for helping the show get nominated. The next step is to actually win the category. We'll see how it goes, because Serial Podcast is also nominated in the general category, which is a huge podcast that has hit the mainstream market. So as many votes as we can get in there, definitely appreciate that. Again, you can go to podcastawards.com. Daily voting opens tomorrow. So from tomorrow on out, vote every day, please, at least once. So going back to the UConn Health Center Rare Disease 2015 event, again, it was held by Sophia Walker, and there was four presentations. So I kind of want to go through the highlights of each presentation and what I got out of the experience. Before I go into each presentation, I do want to give a little glimpse of rare disease facts. So starting with, what is a rare disease? Obviously, it's not a disease that's affecting a lot of people. This is a disease affecting fewer than 200,000 Americans. It's considered rare. And so how many rare diseases are there? Now, according to the National Institute of Health, there are approximately 7,000 rare diseases, and there are approximately 30 million Americans who have rare diseases. So most rare diseases are genetic, which is kind of why I'm talking about it on my genetic show here. And two-thirds of people that are affected are children, but the other third have an adult onset. And so what are the special problems that people with rare diseases have? So people with rare diseases are medically underserved population, and they have a lot of challenges because of this. They have difficulty obtaining an accurate diagnosis. Many patients see multiple specialists prior to diagnosis, and they have limited treatment options. Only about 350 of the 7,000 rare diseases. Again, 350 of the 7,000 rare diseases have FDA-approved treatments. And little or no research has been done on many of these diseases because it's not a lucrative market, because you only have so many people that would buy this drug. So to put in a lot of money to create the drug, you're not going to get a lot of money of that back. Whereas if you focus on a disease that a lot of people have, then it's more likely that you're going to make that money back. So that's a huge issue within rare diseases, and that is why they're really pushing for more federal funding and to be able to explore and research these diseases to have treatments and cures. So this is definitely an underrepresented population. And so that's why I like to highlight it on the show, to make people more aware that rare diseases are a huge issue. And I think one of the most surprising things I learned from going there, and it's still kind of blowing my mind that this is true, but 1 in 10 Americans have a rare disease. So you might be like, hold on, 1 in 10 Americans? But because there are so many different rare diseases, this fact is true. So a rare disease in itself affects fewer than 200,000 Americans. However, rare diseases in general, because there's 7,000 rare diseases around, it affects 1 in 10 Americans. So that is quite a lot of people. So they may be underrepresented, but because they are all kind of spaced out into different diseases. So they can't all be treated the same, obviously. So the first presentation was by Dr. Anton Alerte, and he is an assistant professor in pediatrics, and he runs the clinical medical course at UConn Health Center. And so he kind of went over a lot of what I just said, of the general ideas of rare diseases, and that, again, I want to stress that most have a genetic component. So that's why it's kind of important to highlight within the realm of genetics that rare diseases are a major issue. And there has been legislation to help with federal funding. However, it's still not being researched enough. And the legislation I'm referring to is the Orphan Disease Act. And this was to help with federal funding, but it's still not as good as a lot of people would like to see. Again, because the research is not as lucrative. So you have less customers to sell to, and you have, you know, less of a market out there. So Dr. Anton talked about two cases that he had in his career that he really wanted to highlight. And the first was in 1997 in the NICU. There was a beautiful baby boy, as he said, in an incubator. And he has VATER. And that stands for different characteristics that this boy has. And it's a rare disease, obviously. And the first is vertebral abnormalities, which means that the spinal cord has kind of stuck together, so it's not separated and be able to move regularly. Also an imperforated anus, which means that the anus is not open and surgery is needed in order for it to be functional. And also this characteristic that makes the stomach not connected to the esophagus and to be able to eat food and everything to pass through smoothly, which kind of goes back to the imperforated anus, that the digestive tract is not exactly smooth and flowing. The last one is renal, so kidney abnormalities. And chromosome 12 is involved in this rare disease. And there's also a sub-disease to this that has cardiac issues, along with all the other issues I just said. And this happens in one in 10,000 to one in 40,000 live births. So again, we're talking about rare diseases. So it's not affecting a lot of people. The more positive side to this rare disease is that the prognosis is good and IQ is not affected. So your intellectual ability is not affected if you have this rare disease, which is different from many rare diseases. A lot of rare diseases we see do affect the IQ. So when something doesn't and surgeries are able to fix these characteristics of the disorder, the prognosis is good because you have to go through the surgeries and obviously it's devastating. However, in the end, a lot of people end up being, you know, livable and can survive. The second case he talked about was a little bit more personable. He shared his name. His name is Jakari, and he has wolf hishorn. And this is, the characteristic of this is a Greek warrior helmet-shaped birthmark. And people with this also have a broad, flat nasal bridge and a high forehead. Their eyes are widely spaced and maybe protruding a little bit. They also have a small chin and small head, and so that's kind of the facial features. Now, there's also a delayed in growth and development and intellectual disabilities and seizures that they experience. So they also have a weak muscle tone known as hypotonia, and they have underdeveloped muscles. So motor skills such as sitting, standing, and walking are significantly delayed compared to their peers without this disorder. So most children and adults with this disorder also have a short stature. Now, their social skills are strong when you compare them to people with other forms of intellectual disability, while their verbal communication language skills tend to be a little bit weaker. And seizures tend to disappear with age, which is one of the more positive things in this syndrome. And it occurs in about twice as many females as males, and we're not sure why this is. That it's affecting more females than males. And it's, again, it's about twice as many females as males. So not sure why exactly that's the case, but for right now, we know that it's the case and that's it. So deletion of genetic material near the end of the short P arm of the chromosome 4, and the chromosome is folding in on itself, and that's what's different about this, and that's what kind of the mutation is. The prognosis for this is not as good as the first case I discussed. The prognosis is that the baby will die within a year. And I want you to remember that when I say something a little bit later, that the prognosis is that the baby will die within a year. So the deletion, again, is 4P because there's a deletion on the chromosome 4 on the P arm, which is the short arm. P for petite is how I like to remember it. And so it's also folding in on itself, which is why this is happening. Now, studies suggest that larger deletions tend to result in more severe intellectual disabilities and physical abnormalities than smaller deletions. And this is something that I've talked about on previous shows, where if you have more mutations, the characteristics and the impact of the disorder or disease tends to be more. So if you have more deletions and more things are abnormal, then your characteristics are going to also be more abnormal. So that's kind of positive correlation there between mutations and the worse the disease gets. So there are three main genes that are deleted in people with this disorder. WHSC1, LETM1, and MSX1. Those are the main genes that are missing in people with this disorder. So obviously, because they have been identified as missing, they must have a key role in, their absence has a key role, I should say, in their characteristics of the disorder. And between 85 and 90% of all cases of the syndrome are not inherited. So you might say, okay, then how do they even get it if it's not inherited, if their parents are passing that information along to their children? So this is a result of a chromosome deletion that occurs as a random, or de novo, we call, event during the formation of reproductive cells. So reproductive cells, again, are eggs and sperm. And this is early in embryonic development. So we're not saying dad has this mutation, or say he's a carrier for this mutation. That's not the case here. We're talking about a random event happening, a de novo event happening during the formation of the eggs or sperm, and it can also happen early in embryonic development. So the parents can be normal and healthy. However, if something happens randomly and has these random deletions, this disorder can persist. So it happens in one in about 50,000 live births. And so it's a rare disease. And to remind you, rare diseases affect fewer than 200,000 Americans. But this happens in about one in 50,000 live births. So remember when I mentioned the prognosis of being dead within a year? Jakari, who was little boy that Dr. Anton was working with on this case, and he is now 12 years old, and he's 27 pounds, which is unheard of. It's a miracle, and it's a wonderful thing, I'm sure, as a doctor to, you know, be taking care and having a major role in this child's life and seeing them go way beyond the prognosis. So very exciting. And he's a happy boy, and he even jokes around a lot by pulling out his fake eye and playing with it and kind of freaking other kids out. So it's very exciting to hear that, you know, just because prognosis, that's, you know, an estimated. But there are some miracle cases, as we like to call them, that really do persist longer than that. And Dr. Anton talked a lot about the experience of the patient and the frustrations when trying to identify and treat a rare disorder, that there is so much difficulty in finding physicians or treatment centers with experience in treating a particular rare disease. And treatments are generally more expensive than those for common diseases because they're not as readily available as other diseases or other treatments for other diseases. And reimbursement issues are related to private insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and there's difficulty in accessing medical, social, or financial services or assistance because of those making the decisions are not familiar with the disease. That, you know, rare diseases, most doctors are not aware of them. That's why they're called rare diseases. But there is a push in the medical field to learn about rare diseases overall so that doctors are able to identify, all right, this is a rare disease, and at least put it in that category to then further explore and find treatments or cures or something to at least a diagnosis to start to push the families in the right direction, because not knowing the diagnosis of your child can be very difficult. So he talked a lot about this, and he had an awesome, awesome presentation that was very informative. So the second presentation I want to talk about, it was from Juliet and Tara, and Juliet and Tara Lynn. And Juliet is the child that has FABA, which is adipose vascular abnormalities. And Tara is her mom, and she has 10 years of experience being an OT, which has really helped help her own daughter just learning, you know, adaptive, you know, different ways of doing things to, you know, get her through the day and things like that. And Juliet has a red spot on her inner thigh, which has been changing ever since she's been growing. And it started out as the size of a pencil eraser and has changed from there. It's gotten bigger, smaller, and really been changing. And because of this, Juliet is in constant pain with no end in sight. And her family went to one doctor to the next. Kind of, this was a great presentation following Dr. Anton's because it really explored now the patient side of things of how frustrating it can be to get, you know, doctor after doctor not knowing. And the not knowing is really the scariest part that you don't know what to expect. They had a potential diagnosis, but nothing definite and all different treatments that were kind of a shot in the dark. They visited Boston Children's Vascular Abnormality Center, and that's made up of about 25 physicians. So they visited there, and they went back there later that I'll get to. She has normal tissue. However, there's adipose there instead of other types of normal tissue. And the nervous tissue is also intertwined with it, which is causing her pain. And after, you know, Googling, once they found out that she had FAVA, there was not a lot of information out there. So even though they have this diagnosis, they still don't really know what to expect because there isn't a lot of information out there. And finally, a paper was published that provided some information to the medical community. And so this was kind of going along with her diagnosis. And this is that her muscle fibers replaced by intramuscular lesions, extremities, and chronic pain and dysfunction swelling. That's kind of her diagnosis. And there's two surgical treatment options, and I believe they went through both. She went through CO2 laser and embolization of dilated veins. And in August 2013, she had her first surgery, and the pain unfortunately did not leave after surgery. Julia is such an inspiring young woman, and the way her mother would, you know, talk about her just being so strong and even mentioning that she cleaned her own wounds after this. Just very, very mature young lady. And you could really just see how she just kind of takes everything in stride and sees things on the positive side and, you know, acknowledges her rare disease, but kind of says, yep, this is what I have and I'm just going to keep going. And she's very, very inspirational. And so her mother went on to say later in the presentation, they went back to the Boston Children's Hospital to try cryoablation procedure. And before they did this, they were inspired to start their own foundation because there wasn't a lot of resources out there for people that had FAVA. So they started the FAVA Foundation, which supports research, and you can go to favafoundation.org to learn more. There's lots of information on there, and I'm kind of blowing through some information, and I wish I had more time to really get into more of what she shared. But they both, Juliet and Tara, really shared with the community what it's like to be a patient, but how you can really get people together. And in October 2014, they started a support group of kids and adults who have found that they had FAVA and then found this organization. So they've been united together, and you know, it's because of the FAVA Foundation that they started. So they are hoping to support research funds and to someday find a cure or treatment. So it's very exciting, and definitely go to favafoundation.org to learn more, because that is just a glimpse of what they talked about and what's available on their website. Another presentation was from Dr. Caroline Dealey, and she is from the Form and Function Growth and Skeletal Health at UConn Health Center. And she talked a lot about chondroplasia. And this is a type of dwarfism that people probably know it because Warwick Davis has it. He's a famous actor that was in the Harry Potter movies. That's how I first knew about him. And so she talked about how mutations in type 2 collagen causes this chondroplasia. And it's caused by less than 20 distinct mutations in the collagen type 2 gene. And I'm going to back up for a second. Collagen is this thick tissue, and it has a helical structure, or it's cartilage, and it has a helical structure and occurs in less than 1 in 200,000 live births. So this is way more than we've been talking about before. I mentioned 1 in 40,000 or 1 in 50,000. Now we're talking about 1 in 200,000 live births. And this mutation called SEDC mutation disrupts this type 2 collagen so that it's not as tightly folded as it should be. And because of this, it can't get out of the cell because it's not the right size. It can't be exported out of the cell. So therefore, the cells swell, which can cause cell death. Now, chondroplasia has no treatments and growth hormones have not been successful. There are some surgeries that can help. However, they're a little bit gruesome, involving breaking the leg and stretching it to grow, which is kind of controversial. And it's hard to identify drugs for drug intervention of this type 2 collagen not tightly folding and not folding properly. So it's hard to find drugs to intervene. But if they can, they could intervene on certain cellular pathways to treat the disease. And Dr. Caroline Dealey talked a lot about induced pluripotent stem cells being used for research in this realm. And these are a type of pluripotent stem cells that can be generated from adult cells. And mature cells can be reprogrammed to become pluripotent. So pluripotent means many, like pluri, and potentials, potent, so many potentials. So in other words, these cells have the potential of taking on many fates in the body, including all of the more than 200 different cell types. So for example, embryonic stem cells are pluripotent because they can become any type of cell. They can become an eye cell, a cheek cell, a liver cell, you know, anything. So they have the potential to become many things. So pluripotent, many potentials. So they can propagate indefinitely as well as give rise to any other cell type in the body. Again, neurons, heart, pancreatic, liver cells, so many different types. And they represent a single source of cells that can be used to replace those lost to damage or disease. So how this works is patients' cells are taken and exposed to 4 different chemicals. And because of these chemicals, they are reprogrammed to act like stem cells. So you can take an adult cell that has already been differentiated, meaning it's already been chosen to act like a certain cell and be a certain cell, like a liver cell or something, and now it's kind of digressing back to acting like a stem cell, where it can become a different kind of cell. So it's kind of going back to square one and restarting from there. So what's great about this method is there's an indefinite supply of the patient's own cells. So, you know, as a person, you have so many cells in your body that you can keep supplying cells and they can keep working with it and putting it in, have the induced pluripotent stem cell. Induced meaning that they are putting these chemicals, these 4 certain chemicals, and exposing the cells to it so that they become pluripotent stem cells. So that's what the induced part of that phrase is. And again, they can keep supplying cells and so research can continue. And, you know, by giving the cells, they can then get these stem cells. So it's a really cool advancement in science, and I've always kind of been interested in that. I would definitely suggest looking into that. The last presentation from Ethan Talbot. He's a third-year medical student, and he has a rare condition that runs in his family. And this was the 6th year that he spoke at the annual event of the Rare Disease 2015. And the disorder that runs in his family is myotubular myopathy, which is an X-linked disease, meaning that the mother carries it. So his aunt, his mom, a lot of them carry this disease and have passed it on to kids in the family. So happening through generations, and his family is the family with the most cases on record in the entire world. So it's kind of, he likes to say, his family's disease. And this disease is caused by a defective protein, myotubularin respirator protein, and it causes floppy muscles and therefore makes the patient wheelchair bound, and also that they need a respirator. So it's a very serious disease that really, really affects the person. And it's hard to manage the complications. It can be done to just manage them, but there's really no effective treatment or cure for it. Now, when you look at muscle cells from people with this disorder, the nucleus is in the center of the cell, as opposed to the kind of outside, not directly in the center. And Ethan discussed the theme of miracles within his family regarding this disease. And this might sound a little weird that your family has this horrible rare disease and you're looking at miracles with it. But I'm going to talk about two main miracles that he really highlighted during his talk, which he's very well spoken and really, really gave it a story aspect and really captures the audience. So the first miracle is that Joshua Fraze, who was born to a dad who is a pro football player, had this disease. And when there is a celebrity or someone with a lot of money related to the disease, if it affects their family, a close friend, someone, usually gets picked up by media a little bit and there's money behind it. So the pro football player, Paul Fraze, donated $6 million so far in research just for this one disease. There are labs in Harvard, North Carolina, and France that he has donated money to that have been built up to focus on this disease. And it's a rare disease because it only affects 300 people in the world. Again, this disease is myotubular myopathy. And Ethan's family, the presenter, formed a connection with the Fraze family, and this led to Paul Fraze setting up Ethan to work in his own family's disease in the Harvard laboratory. So Ethan was able to not only work on a rare disease and do research for it, seeking to find treatments and cures for it, for a community of people that are really affected by this, but also that it affects his family. So he was very, he kind of beamed with kind of pride that he was able to research his own family's disease and make advancements in finding these treatments. Now, Joshua Fraze died in 2010 on Christmas Eve, and it was very touching to see that Ethan's presentation name was, "None of you are just another brick in the wall." And this is a quote from Joshua that he would always tell his friends to inspire them to really continue on and strive for goals, and that, you know, you're not just another brick in the wall. You are more than that, and that you have to continue striving for goals and to stay inspired. And it's really cool. You can go to the website joshuafraze.org. And there's a lot of cool quotes from him and Joshua's story and just how of an inspirational guy this was, that he was. And it's definitely great. Definitely check out joshuafraze.com. And Ethan's cousin, Patrick, died in 2004 at age 11. He had 100 seizures in a day, and it was just too much for his body to handle. But there have been huge advancements in research for myotubular myopathy. And there was a new paper with findings published in 2013, so very recently, the past 2 years. And this paper expresses the success of injecting an enzyme for replacement therapy. And what is happening is that this injection is an enzyme for replacement therapy in the veins of muscles of mice. So it's directly injected in the veins and muscles of these mice. And there have been much improvements in mice that have had this treatment. So the first miracle I talked about was the Fraze family just being able to help with the myotubular myopathy community and having treatment and seeking treatment options with the money that they had. And so with this, this kind of blows my mind. This is very interesting. The other miracle is when the Fraze family were on a vacation and they were at a diner, just, you know, random diner, you know, probably off a highway or something, and they were telling the waitress about their story. And she said that there was a farm up the road where puppies were experiencing a very similar condition to what they were describing that Joshua had. And it turns out that the puppies had the same condition that Joshua and Patrick had, and it even had the same gene that was compromised. So they had exactly the same condition, which is fantastic because these puppies can then be used for research to then find a cure. So you don't, a lot of times when research, where you're looking for a cure and we're looking to do research on organisms, we have to inject the affected gene into the organisms. But here, that was already done. They found naturally occurring puppies with this gene compromised. So they didn't have to spend all that money on developing that technology of developing the gene and then injecting it. It already occurred. So the dogs were utilized in research, and there was a genetic therapy treatment that has found success in treating the puppies and in the mice I mentioned before. And this new round of treatment has just started in 2014, and they don't have full strength, but they have a great, great, great improvement in their abilities with their muscles. So it's very exciting to hear that they have this. And so you know, I said that it would cost a lot of money to develop animals like this to do testing on, and the virus that delivers the genes in genetic therapy. So how genetic therapy works, a quick overview, is that viruses can be used to deliver genes into the body and introduce them into the body. So a virus that you pick up, basically what it does is it injects its genetic information into your cells, and those cells then produce the proteins from the genes that were injected, and then you start producing proteins that you really shouldn't be. Now, this technology and this kind of setup can be used in genetic therapy because you can introduce a gene into the body that can actually be beneficial. So they didn't have to do any of this. So it was already occurring. So it costs around $50,000, which may at first sounds like a lot, but when you think about pharmaceutical industry and how much money things are and how many years it takes to do things, all the different phases that drugs go through, it really is not that much compared to other drugs. So it was definitely amazing to hear from Ethan, and just such an inspirational guy and really, really resilient. And you can see from his family, see from how he talks about his family that he really is, you know, a great guy that is talking a lot about his own experiences with his family's disease. Next episode, next week at 11:30 a.m. Monday. And the show is DNA Today, and you want to remember that because when you go and vote for the podcast awards, you're going to scroll down to the left side of the page, go to general category and select DNA Today, then scroll to the bottom and submit your information. Again, that's podcastawards.com. Go to the general category on the left and please vote. We're up against cereal. I need as many votes as I can get. You can learn more about the show at dnapodcast.com, and there's a contact forum on there if you have any questions. I love, love, love receiving emails. I love feedback from you guys, what you want me to cover. If I said something wrong, I definitely want to know, so give me constructive criticism. And you can also shout out to me on Twitter at dnapodcast. You can follow me on Twitter at kiradineen. Again, I'm Kira Dineen on Twitter. And if you don't like the contact form on the website, you can email in directly at info@dnapodcast.com. So questions, comments, concerns, everything. info@dnapodcast.com. And I also want to mention favafoundation.org and rarediseases.org. Rarediseases.org is NORD's website. And definitely want you to check that out. So thanks for listening, and join me next week again, Monday at 11:30 a.m. on whus.org or 91.7 FM to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.